Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today, we're going to talk about a topic I've actually just recently learned about, mental health first aid. The idea is to train citizen responders or members of the public to respond to mental health crises. Mental health first aid training courses help members of the public identify and respond to signs of mental illness, whether in their colleagues, friends, or family members. We'll be talking about the topic today with Julie Hartle, who is currently the Manager of Recovery and Resiliency for Optum Salt Lake County and has spent many years as a mental health care provider. Welcome, Julie Hartle.
Thank you.
So first of all, one of the things that you've mentioned is that going into the field you're in now has required something of a lived experience. And I always ask people at the beginning of the podcast to tell listeners a little bit about themselves. So could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the field that you're in now?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So in my present position with Optum, Optum Behavioral Solutions, one of the requirements for the job that I have is that I have lived experience with serious mental illness and or substance use disorder. So 25 years ago when I began my career, I would have never thought that I would be working in behavioral health, but it just so happens that I had those challenges that presented themselves. And I was diagnosed with serious mental illness and had challenges with substance use disorder, which then directed my career path. I had about 5 or 6 years where I was unable to work. I couldn't sustain employment, and so I lived on disability. But over time, as my mental health got better, and I was able to kind of figure out how I find a place of stability and balance and even thrive, then, of course, I was very interested in sharing my lived experience with those who were still challenged. And so that's how I got into this field. It was kind of a roundabout way, but because of my own lived experience, I have a lot of passion around sharing this information and knowledge with other people.
Yeah, definitely. And what exactly is your work as the Manager of Recovery and Resiliency? How do you use your experience there to help others?
One of the things that is really important to my company, my organization, is that they see things from a consumer perspective, or they understand things from the perspective of the person who's actually receiving the services. So while, you know, our professional clinicians, psychiatrists, licensed clinical social workers, all those people have a vast amount of knowledge, you know, obviously much of that is book learning. And what I bring to the table is my lived experience. Mm. And it's important to them, to this organization, to know how programs might work for someone with that lived experience. And so that's what I offer, is whether or not, you know, something is going to be successful based on that experience. I provide a lot of advocacy for those with mental health and substance use disorder challenges. And I do a lot of training around trying to break down the stigma or the discrimination that people with serious mental illness or substance disorder face in our communities.
Wow, that's actually really interesting. There's been a lot of talk about patient advocacy. There are a lot of patient advocacy groups, a lot of citizen advocacy, but to have someone actually in the organization whose role is to bring the patient or customer perspective to the table, that seems unusual.
Yeah, it is. It is a little unusual. And if you think of it this way, I work for a managed care organization. So, you know, we're the people that are actually the administrators of health care and behavioral health care for millions of people. You know, a lot of people don't know or understand what, you know, like a Fortune 5 company is, but United Health Group is a, you know, Fortune 5 company. And who would have thought 10 years ago that I would be working as a manager of recovery and resiliency for a corporation, you know, in the United States? It's kind of an odd situation. And there, we have managers of recovery and resiliency all across the company or all across the country that do the same thing I do because they feel passionate about making sure that we take that lived experience into consideration and let it drive all of the work that we do.
And is that a job that requires this lived experience in every case for all of these different managers of recovery and resiliency?
Yes. They need to have either lived experience themselves or have been like the primary caregiver for someone who is seriously mentally ill or who has had substance use disorder. But most of us actually have our own lived experience.
That's interesting. That's very impressive. I'd like to transition a little and talk more specifically about mental health first aid now. I know it's something that a lot of our listeners won't have heard of. So can you just walk us through basically what is mental health first aid and why is it relevant in emergency services and emergency dispatch?
Well, mental health first aid, it's interesting because it was first created by a public health nurse in Australia. Her name is Betty Kitchener, and that was way back in 2001. And it really took off there, and the thing that was useful was that it did provide people with skills they could actually use. A lot of times, you know, we think of, on the physical side, first aid, CPR. You know, a lot of people take those courses and are certified in those courses. And so if they come across someone who's having a medical emergency, they know what to do. The person's bleeding, apply pressure. You know, they know those steps. But it's actually much more common that you would come across someone who's experiencing emotional distress or psychiatric distress. And we don't really have the tools, likely because of the discrimination or the stigma around mental illness and substance use disorder. So she put together this program. And it has taken off. It is offered in countries all over the world. It's offered in China, in Denmark, in, you know, England. It's really offered pretty much everywhere now. And several years ago, here in the United States, in 2008, the National Council of Behavioral Health decided that this was something that they wanted to offer to people in the United States, and it's really spread across the country since then.
One of the things that I found most compelling about this when I was reading about it was that there's this idea that it should become as common as CPR, that there's a desire to train many members of the public, maybe all members of the public, in some basic level of mental health first aid, so that if they come across someone, whether it's a family member or a colleague or what have you, who's experiencing one of these issues, they can do something.
Exactly.
How long do you think that might take, or where do you think you are in that movement?
Well, I know that in 2014, as a part of looking at behavioral health services, the Presidential Commission actually provided a lot of funding so that mental health first aid classes could be offered in a lot of places that they currently weren't. And I think presently there are about 500,000 people that have been certified in mental health first aid. So we're getting there. We really are getting there. And I know here in the state of Utah, in Salt Lake County, we are continually offering mental health first aid and some other trainings. So people have some tools in the toolbox. You know, we all fear what we don't know, or what we don't know how to, if we don't know what helps a person who, say, is having a panic attack, then that's a fearful situation for us, as well as the traumatic situation that they're going through.
Mm-hmm. So I know you don't want to get into too much detail about it, but what are some of the skills that are trained in these programs?
Well, you know, there's a little acronym that's used, just like CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Well, there's an acronym that's used in mental health first aid. And the acronym is ALGEE, A-L-G-E-E. And it's, when you go through the training, you go through that so many times, you get out of the training and, you know, it's literally embedded in your mind. But it stands for this. The A is for assess for the risk of suicide. That's the first thing that you need to do. L stands for listen non-judgmentally. A lot of times people with mental illness, we do have a tendency to judge that situation. And because in the past, you know, in decades past, these were felt to be, you know, character flaws and that kind of thing, that information is still sometimes out there. So listen non-judgmentally. The G is for always give assurance and information. E, encourage appropriate professional help. You know, give a person as much encouragement as you can right there in this situation, and then encourage them to seek help and help them get help if you're able to do that. And then also encourage self-help and other, you know, support strategies that we know can work sometimes.
You know, listening to that, the first thing I think of is this is a form of triage. I mean, what emergency dispatchers do is they first seek to identify whether there are any immediately obvious high priority symptoms or conditions, which is, you're talking about suicidality as your first question. And then they listen, they ask a question, tell me exactly what happened so they can know exactly what's going on. They provide encouragement and support, and then they connect someone to the right resources. So I think dispatchers will see this as very similar to what they do.
Yeah, it really is. It is a form of triage. And, you know, it's so much better, you know, if you're walking down the street and you see someone who's obviously in distress, you know, rather than just, you know, walking by. I mean, sometimes, obviously, you know, you need to assess for your own physical safety and things like that. But even if it's a coworker and they appear to, you know, be very anxious or having a panic attack or that, I mean, these are all things that you can do. And this is how we take care of each other in our community. And they're not hard things to do. It's just the case of, okay, so those are the steps, and that's how I can go about, you know, helping this person get the help that they need. And when you go through the course, you go through all of the different anxiety. Panic attacks are included there. You know, what are the first aid steps for panic attacks? You know, what are the first aid steps for someone who has shared with you that they're experiencing suicidal thoughts, or you've even seen, you know, some behaviors that concern you? We have, like, first aid pieces for all of those that you learn. So at the end of that 8-hour training, you come away with a whole toolbox, and you no longer have to fear situations. You're empowered to help people.
One of the things that we tell dispatchers is that, for example, if they provide instructions over the phone to someone to give CPR to a loved one, it may be that that loved one won't survive if they had a cardiac arrest. But the dispatcher has still given the caller, the person who helped, the feeling that they did something. And I know I've spoken with a lot of people in the emergency dispatch profession who have had someone experience one of these problems in their center and later wish they had done something, noticed something, said something. And it feels like this is similar to that giving the CPR instructions. You may not ultimately have the effect that you want on the person, but it makes them feel that they have done something, they've intervened in some way.
You know, it's so interesting that you bring that topic up. And I hope this isn't too personal to share. 18 years ago, my father had a heart attack at home. And my mother found him. They didn't live in a real rural area, but they weren't close to a fire station. My mother called 911, and that dispatcher did an absolutely wonderful thing for her. She gave, you know, first she calmed her, and then she gave her step-by-step instructions, you know, what it was that she needed to do. And, you know, my mom got enough sense about her to follow those instructions. And that dispatcher stayed on the line with her until, you know, the fire paramedics responded. And ultimately, my dad passed away. He did not survive that heart attack. But even those first responders, those paramedics, they stayed with her for a good hour, making sure that she was able to contact clergy, you know, her children, that there were a neighbor that could come and be with her until some of us could make it to the house. And, you know, it made all the difference because she felt like she did what she could do. And it really did make a difference. And I think because of that, she didn't have the repercussions of, obviously, it was a traumatic experience that she still recalls. But what she recalls are very kind people who did what they could do to help her in that situation and were very compassionate and very empathetic and really so kind. And as a family, we, to this day, are very grateful for that.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. Emergency dispatchers being behind the scenes sometimes don't hear the outcome of the calls that they handle. And so it can be very helpful for them. It can help them with their own mental health and resiliency to hear that what they're doing makes a difference for families. So I appreciate your sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my parents are people of some means, and there were a lot of donations that came. There were many places that those donations could have gone because my father was very involved in the community. But as a family, we decided that those donations should go to our local dispatch first responders, because it had made that big of a difference on what really for her was probably the worst day in her life.
That connects really well to something that we have dealt with a lot in the emergency dispatch field. When we first introduced what we call pre-arrival instructions, which is that help over the phone, giving CPR instructions or pregnancy or whatever, there was some resistance to it on the grounds of liability. That somehow if a dispatcher was going to give these instructions over the phone, that they or the dispatch center would become liable. We've actually found since then that the opposite is true, that like you're saying, people expect and want to have those instructions given, and that almost never do they blame the dispatcher for a bad outcome. But at first there was this resistance. Do you see that at all with this mental health first aid, that there's some resistance or concern about liability for intervening in a mental health crisis?
You know, I haven't heard that talked about a lot. I think if you do hear about that, it typically is within organizations where they're concerned about that kind of risk and making sure that the appropriate things get done. And most organizations kind of have a protocol, you know, for you to follow. I mean, if X, Y, or Z happens, the first call is to 911. But, you know, once you've made that call, then there are things that you might still be able to do until first responders get there. And that's been more my experience, that there hasn't been a lot of pushback as long as, you know, people are offering some kind of comfort and reassurance. And typically, you know, if you think back about the acronym, it's really just kind of offering some assistance until the professionals get there.
Right. They're not providing professional help. They're not taking the place of a psychologist or psychiatrist. This is more of something to help until they can get them to a professional help.
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the points of the mental health first aid training is that this is not about diagnosing people. This is not about looking at symptoms and saying, oh, obviously this person has schizophrenia or this person has anxiety, you know, generalized anxiety disorder. It's not about diagnosing people at all. It is about teaching people what some of those symptoms look like, because that will help them know how to offer reassurance and comfort. But this is really about just being with a person until professional people can engage and be there to do their professional work.
I'd like to connect this back to the work of the emergency dispatchers, because it seems to me that there are really two ways that emergency dispatchers might utilize this kind of training. One is in their help with the public. So if they're dealing with a caller or they're trying to help a caller who is experiencing mental health crisis, they could use some of these techniques. But maybe even more so in their work with each other and with other first responders. You probably are aware that emergency dispatch has a very high stress level. There's been some research that shows that in some ways it's as high as combat veterans in terms of PTSD. So there are a lot of emotional issues and a lot of stress going on in the emergency dispatch center. Where do you see these kinds of mental health first aid techniques or trainings being helpful for dispatchers?
Well, I think dispatchers probably have some things in common with mental health outreach workers. Hmm. They also, you know, they're engaging people out on the street. And so those are incredibly stressful situations. If you think about a dispatcher, you know, you think about my mom's situation. She knew CPR. She'd probably taken CPR. She was a school teacher, retired school teacher. She probably had to take CPR, you know, across her career 10 times. But when you're faced with that situation, you kind of forget things, and you need somebody to give you reassurance and to be there with you and tell you how to work through that situation. I think dispatchers do an incredible job for us, and it is a very stressful job. They're behind the scenes, and they don't get a lot of credit for what they do, and I think sometimes they don't even know likely the outcome of what situations are. But if you have these skills, you can certainly work to support each other, you know, in your place of employment and look, you know, for signs and just be upfront with people and say, I always encourage people, take your break, you know, because sometimes, you know, there's encouragement or to not do things like that. Mm-hmm. You need to actually de-stress in the situation. You need to know what the signs are so that you can help a coworker, or you can look for things and then, you know, again, you know, ask them how they're doing. You know, try and engage them in conversation. Again, listen non-judgmentally. Give them reassurance. I think as professionals, one of the things that we need to hear sometimes is there is absolutely no shame in getting professional help yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not about powering through. This is about taking care of yourself.
I know that the mental health first aid specifically has to do with an in-the-moment current crisis or a current stressful situation. But do you have any other types of recommendations for people in these kinds of stressful conditions, like an emergency dispatcher who maybe deal with this all day and may not have a specific incident that they're working with? What are ways that they can prevent these kinds of mental health issues, or what are ways that they can care for themselves, as you're saying?
Well, we hear a lot about self-care. You know, it's kind of one of those phrases that we talk a lot about, but sometimes, you know, really, what does that mean? Well, for me, I can only speak from my experience, and I can say that I have compiled, I like to think of it as a toolbox, a red toolbox that has all kinds of tools in it that help me in these stressful situations, this stressful job. And I think there are a lot of things that you can put in your toolbox. Now, you know, one person, things work for different people. So they have to be, somewhat personalized, but you only know if it's going to work if you try it, right? So for me, one of the things that I try and do is keep my work life separate from my home life or my family life. And one of the things I have found that helps me do that is to have a little ritual of transition when I leave work and go home. And for me, one of the things that works is I have a couple of songs that I like to listen to on my way home that are very uplifting and kind of help me forget some of the things that I've experienced at work. I have a commute in traffic, so another thing I work on is breathing. And I just do it for 20, breaths in, exhale, very slowly, the diaphragmatic breathing. Now, those sound like little things, and I know a lot of times, people refer to them as kind of foo-foo things, but for me, they work. They really work. And those are some of the things. I know others who like to just, take a short walk when they get home, or the first thing they do is, play with their dogs. Anything that uses our senses generally brings us present to that present moment and helps us put what we've gone through during the day aside. And there are all kinds of things that you can do for that.
That's very helpful. I hadn't thought of it in quite that way. I had heard some of those ideas, especially about separating work and home life, but the idea of being in the present moment and using sensory inputs to do that, that's interesting and very helpful. I actually hate to draw this to a close, but I have just one more question, which is, clearly, mental health issues have become more visible. They've become more acceptable to talk about, although there's still that stigma that you're talking about. Do you see that trend continuing? Where do you see this movement headed, and where do you see public health for mental health issues going?
Well, I think we're coming more and more out of the dark and into the light so that it is more acceptable to talk about and to acknowledge and to admit that, sometimes this is a challenge. This is a challenge for most all of us. In any given year, 1 in 5 people will experience a mental health challenge. So, we don't have to think of this as always someone else. This can be us. It can be a close friend. It can be a family member. And so I think it's good that we're coming out of the light because we need to. I think the other thing that plays into this is we live in an incredibly stressful world with lots of things going on. And so I think and this is just anecdotally, this is just my personal experience, but I think we do have a higher occurrence of some things. Anxiety is the mental illness that is most often diagnosed. I think we could all say at certain times get anxious, and that sometimes that can roll over into something that is actually a problem for us. And so a lot of times that's tied to the stress that we all feel in work, in family life, in expectations, in school, just what's going on around us. And I think, where we're headed is that we will get more information out there, that we will engage people in these ways so it's more acceptable to receive help and to gain access to help is something that I think is incredibly important, and that we'll get the right tools in the hands of people to do better and know how to handle stressful situations better. I know for me, I'm very into running, resistance training, swimming, biking. I do triathlons. Those things are all great ways for me to take the stress away and empower me. I mean, they lift my mood. They make me feel good. And you know, I think when people understand what works for them, they can then do those things and make space in their life for them.
Thank you so very much for being with us today and for sharing that information. We will include some links on our show notes so that people can find out more about mental health first aid. Julie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And I appreciate the light that you've brought to this because I'm passionate about it and it is very important.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardett. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.